As Garrison Keillor once said, a book is a gift you can open again and again. Today, we've asked some of our favorite experts to help you pick the perfect gifts to give and receive this holiday season. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, our annual holiday books show. We'll talk about the best new works of fiction and nonfiction. Jan Weissmiller and Paul Ingram of Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City and Molly Laughlin of The Bookbind in Cherokee have made their lists and checked them twice. So find a pen and listen closely. Tomorrow, we'll be talking about books for kids. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's the most wonderful time of the year. It's time to talk books. Today is the first of our two annual book shows. Tomorrow we're going to talk about books for kids. But first, we get to write our wish lists as grown-ups. We'll talk about the best new works of fiction and nonfiction for grown-ups. Jan Weissmiller and Paul Ingram of Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City are here today. Hello, Jan.
Hello, Charity.
And hello, Paul.
Hello, Charity.
It's so good to have you both here. And we also have Molly Laughlin on the line from The Bookbind in Cherokee. Hello, Molly.
Hello, Charity.
Hey, Molly.
Hi.
Welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
And let's start with fiction. And Jan, I'm going to let you go first today. What's your first book, your pick for fiction?
Well, I'm going to talk about The Luminaries, which you may have heard about already. It's by Eleanor Catton, and it is set in New Zealand, and it won this year's Booker Award, which is has always been the sort of Pulitzer Prize of the English, of England and its colonies, although next year they're going to open up to Americans.
Oh.
Yeah. But anyway, she's 28 years old. She's the youngest person ever to win it, and she's also a graduate of the Iowa Writers Workshop. And the book is really long. I think it's 800 pages long. It's set in the 19th century. It's sort of like a mystery that borders on a regular novel. It sort of feels like Wilkie Collins a little bit, like The Moonstone or The Woman in White. And it's set in the Gold Rush in New Zealand, and it moves between a cast of characters, all of whom are characterized by one sign of the zodiac, which could be weird, but it isn't. She handles the astrological thing in a really interesting way. I mean, she uses the sky in New Zealand, and it lets it feel both contemporary and historic, but it doesn't seem woo-woo at all.
All right, so a little bit mystical, but not. You don't think.
No, it doesn't even seem mystical.
Really?
Exactly.
Okay.
It seems sort of like we feel about the zodiac a little bit.
Right. We read it, but we don't live our lives by it.
You get introduced to sort of a large cast of characters. There's a Maori character. There is obviously people involved with the gold rush. There's a politician. There's a prostitute.
All right.
Yeah.
So it really draws you in. And for 800 pages, it kept you?
Yeah.
All right. So that one is The Luminaries by Eleanor and
Catton, C-A-T-T-O-N.
All right. And Paul, you're up next. What's your first fiction pick?
Okay. In terms of new fiction, I'm very excited about Quiet Dell by Jane Ann Phillips. Takes place in 1930 and is based on a real murder. It's one of these kind of tabloid murders you sometimes see on cable TV where some guy marries a woman with kids and ends up killing them all. But she does a miraculous job of making it not tabloid. I mean, this is high literature. This is really well written. And the character of the newspaper reporter who becomes obsessed with the case is just fabulously done.
And the it's got pictures from that time. It's got old newspaper-like pictures of they have a picture of the parents of the guy who did all the murdering, and they're Iowa farmers, and they're saying, "Yeah, I think that's him." But this is not your kind of book, I can tell.
No. Horrified expression on my face.
Well, yes, but as Jane Ann Phillips was the hottest thing going when I first came to Iowa City. She was a workshop member, and she had her book Black Tickets already out and was getting nominated for stuff. And then she didn't write for a while. And I don't know. This book is just gorgeously written. And even you might like it, Cherry.
All right, Paul. All right, that's Quiet Dell by Jane Ann Phillips. And Molly, what's your first pick?
Well, I have to say that I've become most intrigued by the book called S. And it's by J.J. Abrams, who's a filmmaker, and Doug Dorf, who is a novelist. And basically, it's a book where a young student picks up this book that's left behind by a stranger. And inside are margin notes, which reveals a reader who's enthralled by the story. And the story is called The Ship of Theseus, and its author is V.M. Strata. And she responds alike with notes of her own, which basically begins a correspondence that leads them into the unknown. So they go back and forth responding to each other about the context of the book. And the author's idea was to celebrate the book as an object. And so I wish that I could show everybody this book because it's just fascinating to look at. But basically you have the book, which is The Ship of Theseus, and it's a story of a man who basically is shanghaied into a strange ship with a terrible, violent crew and launched onto a perilous journey. Okay. Then you have the writer, this Straka. He's supposed to be a revolutionary of the world, and nobody really knows anything about this particular author except for the words that he wrote and the rumors that surround him. And then you have the readers, who is Jennifer and Eric, and they are both students, and they face decisions about who they are and what they might become and who to trust and all this. And so they find themselves engrossed into this book. And I know that, you know, we all love to write in our books, or at least I do, and we underline passages that mean something to us and clues that mean something to us about the story or the character or whoever. And so it's an intriguing method of storytelling, and it's just full of mystery and paranoia and love, full of secrets, decoding. You know, they're trying to figure out who is this author and, you know, the translator, is it really the author or isn't it? And you almost have to just look at the book because they have all these little notes that are inserted inside, and it's work reading it, but it's an intriguing method of storytelling.
It's worth it, huh?
Take a look at it. Yeah, definitely. Right. And it really shows the value of the book itself and the words, and I don't know what else to tell you. I think
no,
it's a great book.
That sounds great.
And J.J. Abrams loves to shift paradigms. I hope he's saving enough energy for Star Wars.
Yeah.
So that's a S by J.J. Abrams and Doug Dorst. And that brings us back around to you, Jan, for your second fiction pick.
Well, it's Local Souls by Alan Gurganis. And Alan Gurganis is the author his best-known book is The Oldest Living Confederate Widow Tells All. And it is set in these three linked novellas are set in Falls, North Carolina, which is also where The Oldest Living Confederate Widow Tells All is set. But they're contemporary, and they're wonderful. There's not a page of this book that isn't both moving and delightful.
Well,
and
hardly a sentence.
Hardly a sentence. And I mean, he's digressive. He was very digressive in The Oldest Living Confederate Widow Tells All. But in now, I mean, it's what 20 years later. Everything seems really necessary, and the first story is very I mean, the plots are kind of convoluted, but if you pay close attention, you can follow them easily. And the first one is about a woman who had given up a child and is reunited with that child, although there's a lot of other things going on too. And the second one is about a woman who thinks she's lost a child, and she all well. And the last one is about the last one is probably my favorite, although they're all wonderful. The last one is called The Decoy, and it's about a retiring doctor and his relationship with the narrator of the story. And the doctor is the sort of wonderful, you know, mythic family practitioner who knows all the – who has this sort of common sense and deep kindness and knows all the secrets of
great
all the
voice,
people.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And it's just really a wonderful book. I mean, it's almost like poetry. You can just read it again after you've
wow.
finished.
Well, that's quite a stamp of approval. And, Paul, I sense that you entirely agree.
Oh, absolutely. I would read anything by him.
All right. That's Local Souls by Alan Gerganis. And, Paul, it's back to you.
Okay.
Take it someplace darker? Or
well, actually, it's a little bit dark, but it's not it's called Memoirs of an Imaginary Friend, and it's by Matthew Dix, who is one of my favorite writers. He lives in Madison. He has Asperger's syndrome, and all of his books relate to that problem. And I've talked to him on the phone a couple times, or maybe just on the internet, and he seems fine to me. But this is told from the viewpoint of a kid's imaginary friend, and it's got a wonderful chapter. It's really short. It goes, here is what I know. My name is Budo. I have been alive for 5 years. 5 years is a very long time for someone like me to be alive. Max gave me my name. Max is the only human person who can see me. Max's parents call me an imaginary friend. I love Max's teacher, Mrs. Gosk. I do not like Max's other teacher, Mrs. Patterson. I am not imaginary. And he goes on telling the story and how the deep love that he has for Max. And he talks about other imaginary friends. He knows a bunch of them. They're pals.
That's his social circle.
Yeah, right.
Oh, that sounds great.
I wonder if he knows the one from the Salinger story.
I don't know, but he very well might. It's a but everybody I have – it's in paperback now. Uh-huh. Everybody I have sold this to has come back and said, this is really special.
All right. Memories of an Imaginary Friend by Matthew Dix. Oh, Memoirs of an Imaginary Friend. We'll be back in just a moment. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's our annual holiday book show today. We're talking about the best new works of fiction, and we will get to nonfiction in just a few minutes. We've brought some of Iowa's premier independent booksellers onto the program today to share their picks with us. I have with me in the studio Jan Weissmiller and Paul Ingram of Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City. And Molly Laughlin is on the line with us from the Bookvine in Cherokee. And Molly,
yes.
It's your turn again, your second fiction pick.
All right, Charity. Well, I have to say that I'd like to think that I recommend books to people, but a lot of times my customers recommend books to me. And I had one that continually told me, Molly, you have to read The Dinner by Herman Koch, I believe is the spelling of his last name or the pronunciation.
K-O-C-H, is yeah, that it?
It's right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Is that correct? Yes. And so I went ahead and read it. Now, this is a little bit on the darker side, I admit. It takes place in Amsterdam. Two couples meet at a very fashionable restaurant. The majority of the plot centers around the conversation at the table. And the conversation, of course, starts with polite discourse, but as the evening proceeds, terrible things need to be said. And so each couple has a 15-year-old son, and their boys, who happen to be cousins, are united by their accountability for a horrific act that has triggered an investigation and has shattered their happy world. And so the book is divided into courses. And as the dinner progresses to dessert, the conversation touches on their children and how far the parents are willing to go to protect their child from this incident that they were involved in. It's a psychological thriller, a very fast read, I have to say. I found myself diving into it, and I found myself like switching back and forth who I liked and who I disliked in this book. And
nice.
So I have to say that they really, you know, the author really grabbed me. But I also have to say that it's not for everyone. The subject could be disturbing for some people. And sometimes you just want to wring the necks of some of these characters. And
that's a sign of good writing when you want to throttle the people on the page.
It is.
You bet.
The narrator, you think you really like him, and then you turn. And, oh, so I have to say that it would be a wonderful book discussion for those that can get through it. You know, but really, I have to say that it drew me in enough for me to talk about it today.
Wow. All right. That's
great.
The Dinner by Herman Koch. And next up, we're back to you, Jan.
Well, I think I'm going to talk about this book that was published by Rescue Press, which was started in Iowa City by Danny Colacci and Carol Pagel. And the book is called The Last Word, and it's by Jonathan Blum. And it's actually a novella. It's not long at all. But it's told from the point of view is a man who has a son. He has two families. I mean, he has a son from a first marriage that has just come to live with he and his wife and his children from his second marriage, and this boy is really disturbed. And and you never get to hear from the boy. So so during the entire novella, you're trying to sort of ascertain what's really going on with the boy through the eyes of the child, or through the eyes of the father, who also doesn't know.
Yeah, and he doesn't seem to get a lot of stuff about his son.
Right.
And you know.
Another opportunity to want to throttle the characters.
No. You feel actually very, very empathetic with both the father and the son. And the father is feels very naive to you.
Yeah.
You know, he's very caring, very religious. Uh-huh. And
they go to a Jewish school, and it's very Jewish. There's lots of Yiddish in it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And
so in that respect, there's a lot of humor too, although the situation is not funny.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So that's Last Word by Jonathan Blum. And Paul, we're back to you.
Okay. My last fiction is going to be one of my favorite novelists is Lee Smith from the Appalachians, and her new book is called Guests on Earth. And anybody who's been following fiction of late know that there are about five books about Zelda Fitzgerald, fiction books about
right.
that have to do with it. And this is my favorite because Zelda Fitzgerald is a minor, well, not a minor, but not the center of attention. The center of attention is the daughter of a New Orleans dancer, and she has many problems and ends up in the mental hospital in North Carolina where Zelda Fitzgerald is. The girl is kind of a musical prodigy, and Zelda lets her play piano for the dance classes that she gives. And the characters are the sense that you get of Zelda is not of kind of a lunatic, but
having quite a bit of heart. And the main character whose voice you hear all the time is the girl. And you get she's overwhelmed with music, and she gets she meets an African American woman, and she goes to their church and learns to sing really different kinds of things. But the book is just great. It's there's a tragedy at the end, which I won't remind you of, Charity.
I can be strong when I need to be.
I'm sure.
All right, that's Guests on Earth by Lee Smith.
Yes.
And Molly, we're back to you.
All right. Well, I have chosen Alice Munro's Dear Life. As we know, Alice is the winner of the Nobel Prize in Literature for 2013. And so this is a new collection of her short stories. And basically, most of the ongoing theme between her collection of short stories is that she pinpoints moments in a person's life that is forever altered by a chance encounter, a twist, an action not taken. And her characters are very human. They're flawed. They're full. And you get so much for so little reading that you have to do. I mean, she really is a master at short storytelling. And she also has, at the latter part of her book, she has what she claims is kind of an autobiographical section. I mean, she's not saying that it's all about her, but she's saying that some of the things that are mentioned in those stories are about her own life. And I just think that it's a wonderful collection of stories. And, of course, some you can relate to more than others and some you question, but, boy, she does a great job.
Well, and I think you would find very few who would argue with you on that one. That's Dear Life by Alice Munro. And I know we're getting close to the end of the fiction pile. Jan, do you have another pick, or do we need to move into poetry, or what would
you like to talk about
next?
Maybe I should do poetry.
Okay.
I was going to...
Or you can mention something briefly if you want to.
Well, oh.
we still have so many books to get through.
I think I'll do poetry because I've got two books of poems here, actually. And yesterday in the New York Times, there was an article by David Orr, who is allowed to write about poetry in the New York Times from time to time. And he was talking about the ongoing debate about whether or not poetry should be accessible. And these two books of poems are, I think, accessible to anyone who wants to pay close attention. They're not too obscure, but they're not as accessible as, for instance, Billy Collins. And so they sort of they have a relationship to that argument, I guess.
Okay.
But the first one is Incarnadine by Mary Shebist. And Mary Shebist has just won the National Book Award for this book. She was sort of not the favorite. So it was a great thing when she won it. She's a graduate of the workshop, and then she stayed in Iowa City for 7 years and taught at West High after she finished her MFA.
And she's the sweetest person.
No one would ever say otherwise. But her poems are also really beautiful. And I was just going to and this book, Incarnadine, is almost all is made up of almost all Annunciation poems, you know, the moment that Mary finds out that she's with child.
Uh-huh.
And I'm going to read you this one, may I? It's
sure.
It's not real long, and it's called Annunciation Eve to Ave, I guess. The wings behind the man I never saw. But often, afterward, I dreamed his lips, remembered the slight angle of his hips, his feet among the tulips and the straw. I liked the way his voice deepened as he called. As for the words, I liked the showmanship with which he spoke them. Behind him, distant ships went still. The water was smooth as his jaw. And when I learned that he was not a man, bullwhip, horsewhip, unzip, I could have crawled through thorn and bee, the thick of hive, rosehip, courtship, lordship, gossip, and lavender. But I was quiet, quiet as eagerness, that astonished, dutiful fall.
All right. Yeah. Incarnadine by Mary
Shebist.
Shebist. All right. And you had a second collection of poetry?
Oh, and the other one is a first book by a poet named Carol Light, and it's called Heaven from Steam. And they are, these books have a relationship. I mean, these are not annunciation poems, but they're poems definitely about the life of a woman and over kind of a long period of time. And they're also relatively formal. And really, really beautiful. The last one is the last, or well, the penultimate poem. There's a short last poem, but the penultimate poem is called in a form called The Crown of Sonnets, which is 14 sonnets that are sort of linked in it, and a very hard thing to do, and it's very well done.
All right,
and so.
Heaven from Steam by Carol Light. And, Paul, you don't have any poetry on your list, so I'm going to
How do you know?
Because I've seen your list.
Okay.
So did you bring any
and
poetry?
Because you know me.
Right.
No.
Okay. Then I'm going to skip over to Molly because she does have a little poetry on her list. And then we'll come back to you. Molly,
yes,
let's talk poetry.
Well, I have a dog song, poems by Mary Oliver. And it's, of course, if you've read Mary Oliver, she just really immerses herself in what some people consider man's best friend. And her poems offer a portrait of Oliver's relationship to dogs. And it's a great book for dog lovers and lovers of poetry. The poems, you know, range from anywhere from laughter and love to heartbreak, teaching, you know, lessons of the moment and connection with nature. She just has, for example, school. I'm just going to read this really quickly. You're like a little wild thing that was never sent to school. Sit, I say, and you jump up. Come, I say, and you go galloping down the sand to the nearest dead fish, with which you perfume your sweet neck. It is summer. How many summers does a little dog have? Run, run, Percy. This is our school. And I think it's the type of book that you would just really enjoy to sit down and, especially if you feel close to having an animal or an animal of your own. Yeah.
All right. That's Dog Songs, Poems by Mary Oliver. And if you want something even more irreverent, but still that will ring true, my husband gave me a collection of poetry called I Could Chew on This and Other Poems by Dogs for our anniversary this year.
Very good. Yeah.
It's almost as good as the one that preceded it, which is called I Could Pee on This and Other Poems by Cats. both great stocking stuffers for pet lovers. All right. Now, Paul, you get to choose your category. What do you want to talk about next?
I want to do nonfiction, and I want to do my favorite book so far this year, which is The Leonard Bernstein Letters.
Okay.
Oh. I've discovered that many younger people have no sense of how important Leonard Bernstein was to my generation. I learned classical music from his TV show. I read about it. If there had been tweet, I would have followed him. If there had been Twitter, I would have followed him. And these letters start with when he was a whiny teenager, mad because his father won't take him to see Ravel's Bolero, which was his favorite piece early on. And through his life as a musician and a sort of musical hero, he knew all the musical people in the 30s and 40s and 50s, and he's extremely generous and a brilliant writer and funny. And one of the wonderful things that Nigel Simeone, who edited this, has done is, which hardly any letter collectors ever do is he gets letters back to Leonard Bernstein.
Oh, nice.
And those are wonderful. They some of them are furious, and some one woman writes a really nasty review of some of Bernstein's earlier stuff, and Simeone went and found this person who is still alive, and she and said, "Tell me about this thing." She said, "Well, how did I know he was going to end up being Leonard Bernstein?" And I played some West Side Story to my 9-year-old granddaughter the other day, and she was transfixed. No, it's anybody who is interested in music or popular culture of late and of a true genius of a man just needs to read this. It's as good as a biography.
All right.
Probably better.
All right, that's Leonard Bernstein's Letters, edited by Nigel Simeone. The best book you've read all year, Paul.
Yes.
That's, wow. All right, my guests are Paul Ingram and Jan Weissmiller from Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City and Molly Laughlin of The Bookvine in Cherokee, Iowa. And we're talking about the best fiction and nonfiction books of the holiday season. We'll be back with more in just a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and it's our annual holiday books show. We're talking today about books for grown-ups. Tomorrow, we will be talking about the best books for kids this year. But right now, I've got Jan Weissmiller and Paul Ingram of Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City here with me, along with Molly Laughlin of The Bookvine in Cherokee. And now I've changed up the order, so I don't even know where we're going next. But Molly, I guess we'll go back to you. What would you like to talk about next? It can be fiction or nonfiction.
Well, I'll talk about a nonfiction this time. I'm going to talk about The Boys in the Boat by Daniel James Brown. Mm-hmm. And basically it tells the story of the University of Washington 1936 8-oar crew and their quest for the Olympic gold in Berlin. The boys came from various backgrounds, mostly from out west in the Seattle area, farm boys, loggers, and of course, the outcome, as we know, they defeated the elite rivals from the East and the British universities, and then they went on to defeat the German crew that was rowing for Adolf Hitler. That's a part of the story, but there's more to it. Of course, we have one character, Joe. He's a teenager without a family who's on the team. He has an emotional tug of war in the story. He rows not for the glory, but for a place to call home. But it focuses more than just on them winning. You really kind of get into the inside preparation that it takes to prepare for a race like this. And so Brown has colorful characters, the coach, Al Imbrickson, and actually the British boatmaker, George Pocock, who is not only a mentor to the team but a mentor to the coach, and he was considered to be one of the best boat makers ever. And so you see the inside there of the story, but then also it reminds you just of how the country, when they see a team like this, that they're working really hard with each other and they're trusting each other and they're determined and they're committed, just what can happen. It's a wonderful read. I would say that it reads like a fiction, kind of like an Eric Larson, Devil in the White City, which is really nice because it is over 400 pages. And,
but it really draws you in.
Right, right.
And Molly, you can't see it, but there have been a lot of heads nodding here
in
the studio as well. You're all three in agreement on this one.
Please add. But of course, I love Eric Larson as well. And so it made it very easy to read.
All right. That's Boys in the Boat, Nine Americans and Their Epic Quest for Gold at the 1936 Berlin Olympics by Daniel James Brown. And Jan, we're back to you. What do you want to talk about next? Well, I do want to just talk briefly about the Prayer Journal, Flannery O'Connor's Prayer Journal, which you probably have read about. Flannery O'Connor is probably the most famous graduate of the Writers' Workshop, and she was here in 1946 and 1947. And during that time, she kept she kept a journal of I mean, it's a very intimate thing. It's kind of Marilyn Robinson reviewed it in the New York Times, and she said you feel almost, you know, like
voyeuristic.
Yeah, but on the other hand, she was very aware of herself as a writer, and she was contemplating what it meant to be both a writer and a Christian, and she was working those things out in a way that maybe did feel like she would imagine that somebody would read it sometime. But it's not long, and it's both the text. You see the text, and then you see her own handwriting too. So that's really very interesting. But some of the, I mean, I would of course say that it's most important to read Flannery O'Connor's fiction and her letters. And if you haven't done that, you are really in for a serious experience. And
but if you've done that, this is a wonderful addition.
This is a wonderful addition.
Oh,
and
yeah.
There were just some really kind of, I just had written down a couple of things to quote from it. And one, it was interesting when she was talking about when she was trying to figure out how she would ask God to be a good writer, that, you know, and she's talking about she's asking herself that she might pray for aesthetic craftsmanship in order not to feel lonely. And then she says, people only make us feel lonelier by reminding us of God, which is a really interesting statement.
Right.
And, yeah.
A Prayer Journal by Flannery O'Connor. So take you deeper into the canon, a new addition to the canon of Flannery O'Connor. And, Paul, what's next for you?
I've got a book called Countrymen, The Untold Story of How Denmark's Jews Escaped the Nazis, of the Courage of Their Fellow Danes, and of the Extraordinary Role of the SS Denmark. It's I don't know how many people know this story. They say it's an untold story, but I read a kid's book about it when I was about 10, and it was extremely moving to me. And and this is Bo Lidegaard is the author, and when the Nazis were really getting scary, the Danes knew what it was going to mean for the Jews of Denmark. And over again, they keep saying, these are not Jews. These are Danes. These are our fellow countrymen. And they got boats, and they were very carefully organized, and they took them to Sweden, and which was a neutral country at that time. That's another story. But it's a there aren't very many feel-good stories about the Holocaust, and this is not a feel-great story about the Holocaust.
But a fascinating
but
story.
But it's absolutely interesting. And if you've got any Dane in you, you'll be a little proud.
Nice. All right. That is Countrymen by Bo Lidegaard.
Yeah, Lidegaard. Okay. Yeah.
And Molly, we're back to you. What would you like to talk about next?
Well, I'm going to talk about a nonfiction book. It's called A Bag of Penny Candy, and it's Women of the 1930s, a Collective Memoir. And it's by Sharon Chisel Lemke and Anne Ursula Laughlin. And I'm bringing these two authors up because Sharon is from the Iowa City area, and mm-hmm. Anne Ursula Laughlin grew up in Cherokee, no longer lives here.
Mm-hmm.
But the interesting thing about this book is that these authors went around and interviewed several, I mean...
More than several.
quite a few. Like 30, 40 maybe.
Yeah, right.
Women who grew up in the 1930s. And these women ranged anywhere from 77 to 96, if I was correct in writing that down. But the interesting thing is that they tell their stories. They're a variety of subjects. They're storytellers. They tell about the drought and depression, the rich and the poor, the heartaches and the treasures. And each has a different story. Some live on the farm, some are in the city. It's a dichotomy of life and how they manage through the hard times.
They talk about getting a permanent for the first time, and it's humorous, but mm-hmm. also a little frightening. And, you know, even how the mail was delivered or how important it was to receive a paycheck during that time and the bank failings. And they have ads and, you know, photographs and advice. And I think it's a wonderful collection. I mean, these women, they are speaking for lots of people that lived during that time. And, of course, like one of the ladies said, yes, we had similar experiences, but it's the perspective that we had, how we looked at things that are different. And so I'm bringing this book up. And, Paul, it sounds like maybe you're very familiar with this book
yeah.
as well.
Oh, yeah. It's a great oral history.
Mm-hmm. It really is. I was going to read, I love this one little section because sometimes they would have follow-up little sequels. And it says, if I could just read quickly here, I was born in South Central Iowa, smack in the middle of the Great Depression of the 1930s. I was the fourth child in a family that would number 10. My father was a rural mail carrier, and we always had a check coming in. It was for $50 a week. I didn't know it at the time, but years later, I've been reminded and told, your father always had a check. We were considered rich. To the young folks today, I always remind them to have a check coming in.
That is good advice. Very good advice.
And it's a great gift. And, you know, it's for the young and for the old at heart and the young at heart. And it's a really, I think it would be a wonderful gift for people. And I think we're going to learn a lot.
Yeah.
By reading
all right.
That.
That's a bag of penny candy, Women of the 1930s, a collective memoir by Sharon Sissel Lemke and Anne Ursula Laughlin. And is that a relation of yours?
You know, it is. It's a sister-in-law of mine.
All right. Wonderful. And we have about 5 minutes left. So, Jan, can you give us maybe two titles and just very quickly, we'll end up with two more from each of you.
Well, Ann Patchett has a collection of personal essays that's just come out called This is the Story of a Happy Marriage. And they span a lot of subjects. My favorite one is about her. Her father was a cop with the LAPD. And she writes this essay. She was at Radcliffe. She had that Radcliffe Fellowship, which is a very big deal, when the Rodney King thing happened. And she was just wearing an LAPD T-shirt, you know, because she had one and she was running or something, and she went into a Baskin Robbins and they refused to serve her.
Oh, wow.
And so she had, you know, great respect for her father. And so she went back out to L.A. thinking that maybe she'd actually get into the LAPD, but probably partly just so she could write about it,
right.
You know. But it was really hard. She describes what you have to do to get in, and it's just unbelievable physically.
Huh.
It's unbelievable she did it.
Wow. Well, and if you're an Ann Patchett fan, this sounds right.
Well, not, I mean,
different
not,
than her fiction.
Well,
of course, right?
I respect her. She has a bookstore, you know. She opened a bookstore.
All right.
She's a bookseller.
All right. So and another one in just a couple of sentences. That was, I'm losing my place on my page. What was that one called again? What's the title?
Oh, This is the Story of a Happy Marriage.
This is the Story of a Happy Marriage by Ann Patchett. And one more very quickly, Jan.
Oh, and very quickly, I have this book called A People's Art History of the United States by Nicholas Lempert. And it's sort of based on Howard Zinn's A People's History of the U.S., although it's about activist art. It's about art that has actually changed the way people feel.
Oh. Wow.
And he's got a lot on Danny Lyon, the photographer mm-hmm. from the civil rights
posters.
Movement. Beautiful.
Yeah.
But one of the most interesting things, and I'll just tell this quickly, is that in 1989, they were going to put a nuclear power plant on Staten Island. And all these people put these stamps all over the city and all of the boroughs that told you exactly how far downwind you'd be from the nuclear power plant. And Giuliani was campaigning in favor of that power plant, and Dinkins was against it, and Dinkins won, which was really amazing when you think about it.
Interesting. All right, A People's Art History of the United States, Nicholas Lampert, and Paul, too, quickly.
Okay, quickly. Bill Bryson's new history book, One Summer, America, 1927. He chooses a year that he thinks is particularly interesting and from which many interesting aspects of American culture developed. He talks about Lindbergh. This was the Lindbergh year, and it was. He's a very good writer of history, which I that the book about home,
right?
You know, that was when I read that, I said he needs to do more history. That he is so good. You know, he talks about baseball. This was Babe Ruth's home run year and everything, and it was it's America at a certain time. It's America before the fall of the Depression.
Mm-hmm.
And he has done enormous amounts of just going through newspapers. And I like that.
All right. So that's One Summer by Bill Bryce. And it's about half as long as his book about home.
Yeah, exactly.
But it's still a good, thick book.
Yeah.
All right. Paul, one more quickly.
Douglas Bowers, What Happens Next? Matters of Life and Death. It is a collection of essays by one of Iowa's best authors, published by the University of Iowa Press. He's written any number of novels, which the University of Iowa Press will reissue soon. And this is about him coming back to Iowa when his mother was dying. And the essays are stunning. And he also – and during that time, he was also having a cataract surgery, which I was doing at the same time. I don't – but his writing is just pure gold and makes you proud to be an Iowan. He wrote a book called Prairie City, Iowa, which is one of the best books about Iowa that you will read.
All right. What Happens Next? Matters of Life and Death by Doug Bauer was that one. And Molly, too, very quickly.
Very quickly. Well, first of all, David and Goliath, Underdogs, Misfits, and the Art of Battling Giants by Malcolm Gladwell. He basically challenges the reader about how we think about obstacles and disadvantages, and he shows how players labeled underdogs use that status to their advantage. I thought it was fascinating. He's inspiring. He's intriguing, thought-provoking, and I saw him in person, and so I was really enthralled with him. I had to read this book, and I'm really glad I did.
All right.
And then also, this is just a fun one, but History Decoded by Brad Meltzer. It's the 10 greatest conspiracies of all time. Basically, he takes world unsolved mysteries and he gives us facsimiles, he weighs theories and things that are still maybe unproved or never will be proved. And in the end, he decodes the mysteries and gives the most likely solution. And it's a lot of fun. It's good for history fans and conspiracy buffs and anything like, did Lee Harvey Oswald act alone or is Fort Knox empty?
It does sound like fun. It sounds like maybe a great gift for a teenager, too.
It is, but I could see adults liking it as well.
All right, wonderful.
It's a fun book.
So those two, David and Goliath, Underdogs, Misfits, and the Art of Battling Giants by Malcolm Gladwell, and History Decoded, the 10 Greatest Conspiracies of All Time by Brad Meltzer. Molly Laughlin, thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks for having me today, Charity.
Molly Laughlin of the Bookbine in Cherokee, and Jan Weissmiller and Paul Ingram, thank you again.
Always
thank
a pleasure.
You, Charity.
Jan Weissmiller and Paul Ingram of Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City. Tomorrow on Talk of Iowa, we're going to get the best new fiction and nonfiction books for kids. So tune in for that one as well. We will get this list up on our website and on our Facebook page as we get everything compiled later today. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.